11. You're listening to Bikini Drive-In. Today I'm joined again by Talia Steele. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze foreign science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. Today we are talking about Stanley Kubrick's 1980 film, The Shining. Film center on Jack Torrance, a writer and recovering alcoholic who accepts a job as a winter caretaker for the Overlook Hotel. His family, his wife Wendy and his young son Danny, accompany him and stay in the hotel over the off-season, leaving them in isolation during the frigid winter. As time goes on, the hotel beckons to young Danny, who possesses psychic powers referred to as The Shining, and the family falls deeper into turmoil as the hotel engulfs them. The hotel had a previous winter caretaker who went insane and killed his family and himself. After a winter storm leaves the Torrances snowbound, Jack's sanity deteriorates due to the influence of the supernatural forces that inhabit the hotel, placing his wife and son in danger. Talia, what's your history with The Shining?
So I first saw this movie when I was like 15, and it just like happened to be on TV, and I just sat down and watched the whole thing, and it really got my attention. I'm already like a really big fan of Shelley Duvall. Love the aesthetic of the movie, super spooky, like early 80s, so just like a lot of fun. But yeah, as much as I love this movie, I have to acknowledge all the trauma and abuse that Stanley Kubrick inflicted on Shelley whilst filming. Her performance is so great. She's such a wonderful actor. But the performance in The Shining is so genuine because I feel like her fear and exhaustion from the trauma were so real. Obviously more on that later, but overall, I'm such a huge fan of this movie and story in general. I just love it. How about you?
My first experience with The Shining was, of course, like apparently every other movie I talk about on the show was The Simpsons. But yeah, I watched it probably in my early 20s. And the first time I watched it, I remember falling asleep because I started it at like 12:30 or something. And it's like a very long movie and like kind of a slow build. So I fell asleep and then like woke up to Shelley Duvall like in terror. But I just love it. It's so moody and beautiful and like, yeah, it's really great and so dark. And I haven't read the book, but have you read the book?
I have read the book, yes.
And how is it different from the movie?
I read the book. I absolutely love the book. I'm already like a really big Stephen King fan. I probably like the book a bit more than the movie, like story wise. Like obviously the movie, like for different reasons. But there's actually like a lot of significant differences in the book versus the movie. The famous Grady twins, just like not in the book at all. Like the Grady family and the massacre, of course, are discussed, but like Danny doesn't really ever see them, like that iconic scene like doesn't happen. There's no hedge maze, so I guess that's probably because the ending in the book versus the movie is like entirely different. Big spoiler alert if you have not seen the movie or read the book, but at the end of the book, Stephen King wrote, Jack is lured into the boiler room by Dick Halloran and Wendy. Dick doesn't die either. And then it's just blown up instead of killing him and destroying the hotel. Mm. In the movie, he's lured into the frozen hedge maze and then himself freezes to death by the end while Wendy and Danny escape. So, like, they still escape, but it's just an entirely different way. And then another thing to mention that I found super interesting is that Stephen King really hated the movie and butted heads with Stanley Kubrick a lot about, like, Wendy's portrayal. He said that the movie in general is like a beautiful car with no engine, and then that Wendy is the most misogynistic character ever put into film, and she's basically there to scream and be stupid, and that it's not the woman that I wrote about. So, I mean, I feel like that's really interesting because I really, really love Shelley Duvall in this movie and her portrayal. But in the book, she's like a super strong character, like really quick-witted, and like she gets everyone to safety by making like really smart decisions. Like I feel like in the movie maybe it's more like a more genuine like panic, which
it seems more like she's reacting to things.
In the book maybe like Stephen King wrote her like that on purpose to be like really structured, like I'm not taking any of like Jack's garbage, you know. And the way that Jack is portrayed in the book is different too. His name is John, also, which is random. The Overlook Hotel is obviously haunted and like spooky in the book, and the ghosts and the ghouls in the hotel is like what drive Jack to lose himself. But in the movie, it kind of seems like there's something off about Jack right off the bat. He has like these weird smirks and wide eyes, and it's just overall a bit over the top. But in the book, it's like a really slow descent. Whereas in the movie, it seems more apparent early on, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting. It kind of changes the role of the hotel itself, if you consider the hotel a character, in that it's, like, luring this family in. If that makes sense? Yeah. And, yeah, I feel like Stephen King is such a sentimental writer, as we discussed on our Pet Sematary show. And Stanley Kubrick's film, however, is, like, it's just so completely hopeless, where these, like, violent acts will just continue to happen again and again in the hotel. Wendy and Danny do survive, but they've been traumatized. And I think it's just such a shift from stories we usually see from King, and probably why he famously hates this movie, claiming that the portrayal of Wendy is misogynistic, which is like, I don't really agree with, but I just see her as she's like trying to keep the peace and in a scary, violent home where Jack is like so unpredictable and she's trying to make him happy, or at least happy enough to not lash out. She's just like an abused woman. And I wonder if people hate that character because she's how most people would act in this scenario, or react, where she's just kind of running around frightened, trying to look after her son and get away safely.
Yeah, I know. It's really funny because, like, until Stephen King actually said that, I didn't see her character like that at all. Like, I didn't find her to be misogynistic. I mean, you're right. Like, she acts how most people would act in that scenario, so I'm not really sure what is quite misogynistic about it. It was the 80s as well. I like to think that it's in the 70s. I guess it was filmed in the 70s.
Yeah, and it really looks like a 70s movie because it is so filmed in late 70s. It came out in 1980.
So, I don't know. I feel like they kind of acted differently back then. And, like, it was much more, like, over the top in, like, especially horror movies. And if this was, like, Stanley Kubrick's first horror movie that he did, he probably wanted it to be like the most like scary horror movie ever. I don't know. I feel like Shelley Duvall, her portrayal of Wendy was like super expressive, but she was also like genuinely in distress. So maybe her real emotions were like actually coming out, which like maybe Stanley Kubrick wanted to happen. We'll get to that later, but I just think that Stephen King genuinely just hates Stanley Kubrick so much. So I feel like he'd see anything bad if he could, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I just want to talk about like the division of labor in the film a little bit. So it's interesting to me that Jack Torrance is hired as a caretaker of the Overlook Hotel, but it's actually Wendy who does all the work of maintaining the hotel, cooking the meals, and taking care of Danny. And I just love the relationship between Wendy and Danny so much. Like, their scenes together are so warm and so lovely. Whereas Jack, on the other hand, is isolated, working on his novel. And there are actually like only a few scenes that show the family together. One is when they are driving to the hotel, and I think the next is after Danny has been hurt and approaches Wendy and Jack in the study. And I think it's just like an interesting way to show this like disconnect between all the family members, that they're actually not this unit. Like it's really Wendy and Danny that have the strongest relationship.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
Isolated from each other while they're in this like isolated hotel, and
Yeah.
then
Yeah, even if they're like in the same scene, they're not in the same shot together, really. Yeah, and I feel like Jack is such a, like an early portrayal of toxic masculinity, and that he's like entitled, resentful of his family, calls Wendy disgusting names, and sees himself as this like great writer and this like great thinker, but actually has like nothing to say and contributes nothing to his family.
yeah.
In the podcast, someone else's movie, they discuss how, depending on how you see it, Jack doesn't have anything to say with his writing, and that, yeah, it's all work and no play, and that he has this like grand narrative about himself, but he actually like can't contribute anything. Do you know what I mean? He's like living in this like self-aggrandized like fantasy of himself.
I listened to that podcast and it was so good, and it made me read a bit more about that, like about the toxic masculinity. I found an article entitled "What Stanley Kubrick Got Wrong About The Shining," and Laura Miller wrote, "It's a film in which domestic violence occurs, while King's novel is about domestic violence as a choice certain men make when they refuse to abandon a delusional defensive entitlement." So going on to say that Kubrick's character lacks depth and humanity, and in that way, the movie can't really critique Jack's toxic masculinity as much as it can showcase it without context. So we kind of see Jack become aggressive, or at least passive aggressive. I mean, he did both kind of quickly, and we as a viewer don't really know if like he's always been like this or if it's just the hotel. I think that's kind of what's supposed to mess with your head a little bit. But I remember in the book, like the thing, like I remember Wendy mentions like Jack pulling on Danny's arm and having to go to the doctor, which that happens really early on in the book. So there are like these little snippets of Jack being abusive in the book, and then he'd be like, "Oh, sorry, like I was drinking," or some bad excuse like that. Like we kind of get those little bits earlier in the book, whereas in the movie, it's just kind of like there's no context there. So the horror of Kubrick's Jack plays on fears, the like isolation, uncanny, disturbing visuals. And the horror of King's version of Jack lies within the reader, seeing like parts of themselves within him. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
it is interesting. Yeah, because it is hinted at early on that like Jack has a history of being violent or just kind of like an asshole to his family. And I feel like it almost took me like a few watches to understand that Wendy is like an abused woman, and she just seems like very, not, I don't want to say fragile, but just so like she seemed like she's afraid of Jack. Like when she like offers to make him something and interrupts him while he's working, and he like yells at her. Like she's seemed like she's on the verge of tears at that point. And it's just like, I don't
And
know. It's
everything she
so
does,
upsetting.
I know, she's just so like gentle, like with her words, like you can tell she's like trying to like keep the peace and be like so like just the most positive, like I guess, person in his life that she can be. And like everything that she says, like no matter how nice it is, like or anything, he just will snap back at her. And it's really hard to watch because I'm just like, yeah, she's just like such a sweet character. Like she's so good with Danny and like so caring
And she's
and
doing everything around the hotel
yeah.
and taking
Yeah,
care of her
the movie's like
asshole
about
husband.
her and Danny.
Oh, God. It is, yeah, it's just like heartbreaking to watch the more and more I see it. Because, yeah, on the surface, it is, or even like first viewing, it is just this man sort of like falling into madness or whatever. But the more times you see it, it's like, no, like he has this history of being violent and drinking and being kind of like this terror to his family.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to see it, like take it in as yourself by watching it and seeing it that many times. I guess in the book it's more like laid out for you,
Oh,
but
I see. Okay, yeah. So yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about the Indian burial ground trope that's mentioned in the film. So that we've also discussed this a little bit in Pet Sematary and the Amityville Horror episode. So I have a quote here by Eden Ariel Gordon from an article called "Who's Really Haunting America: Deconstructing the Indian Burial Ground Trope." So they write, by painting Native Americans as supernatural, monolithic entities that torment innocent white families, many classic horror movies play into the white delusions of ownership, entitlement, and victimization. They also recenter the idea that whiteness is a standard that is disrupted or haunted by otherness. Most tropes tell us something about a larger cultural context in which they originate, and the Indian burial ground myth is no different. The narrative of the haunted Indian burial ground hides a certain anxiety about the land on which Americans, specifically white middle-class Americans, live. Embedded deep in the idea of home ownership, the holy grail of American middle-class life, is the idea that we don't, in fact, own the land we just bought. Time and time again in these stories, perfectly average, innocent American families are confronted by ghosts who have persevered for centuries, who remain vengeful for the damage done. Facing these ghosts and expelling them in many of these horror stories becomes a means of refighting the wars of past centuries. Ghosts are a convenient metaphor for a whole host of problems not connected to the supernatural, and talking about them becomes a means to process or make sense of experiences that could otherwise seem overwhelming or mystifying. In short, ghost stories help people comprehend unresolved and unsettling matters. So there's kind of this idea that the Overlook Hotel is haunted because it was built on this so-called like Indian burial ground rather than like it's actually like these terrible men that are treating their families terribly and then like causing all this havoc and violence.
That's really interesting. Like I forgot about that. And, but yeah, they definitely make it out to just be like, oh, it's like a history of like these men just like killing their families. And
Yeah. It's just another way to like sort of place blame on indigenous cultures and to blame an other character rather than to, confront themselves or think about their own actions or whatever. So another trope that we see in this film is something called the magical Negro trope. So this is seen in Scatman Crothers' character, Dick Halloran, who dies pretty brutally and abruptly in the movie, but then not in the book. Right. So I have another quote from Nnedi Okorafor from an article called Stephen King's Super Duper Magical Negroes. And they describe five common attributes of the trope. So, one, he or she is a person of color, typically black, often Native American, in a story about predominantly white characters. He or she seems to have nothing better to do than help the white protagonist, who is often a stranger to the magical Negro at first. He or she disappears, dies, or sacrifices something of great value after a while helping the white protagonist. He or she is uneducated, mentally handicapped, at a low position in life, or all of the above. He or she is wise, patient, spiritually attached, closer to the earth, one might say. He or she often literally has magical powers. And they continue to write, the archetype of the magical Negro is an issue of race. It is a subordination of a minority figure masked as the empowerment of one. The magical Negro has great power and wisdom, yet he or she only uses it to help the white main character. He or she is not only threatening because he or she only seeks to help, never hurt. The main character's well-being comes before the magical Negro's because the main character is of more value and more importance. Stanley Kubrick's choice to kill Halloran's character is kind of strange to me. I'm not entirely sure what the motivation behind that was. Like, his death makes the film much more hopeless, but at the same time, he brutally and quickly kills off the only person of color in the film.
Yeah, that's honestly so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first saw that movie and that happened, and it was like this just such a buildup of Dick Halloran coming like to save them, basically, because like it was like he's the only one that Danny can like communicate with, like you know, for some sort of like hope in the film, right? And then instantly he's like killed, and it's just like, oh my God, like, how is, like, where is this movie gonna go now?
Yeah, like, and it is very shocking and very effective, but at the same time, like, you could assume that a white filmmaker from the 70s, 80s is racist.
Like, it's very apparent, like, now, like, I mean, especially knowing how, like, horrible Stanley Kubrick is, and, like, I would not put that past him at all.
Yeah, but also Stephen King has his own kind of strange relationship with black characters.
I just read the book The Stand, and there's a character, Mother Abigail, who's like the good character, like the main like good character, and she's like a 108-year-old black woman who's like their savior, like in the whole but she also like has The Shining in the book, which is really interesting. And then John Coffey in The Green Mile, both characters are like magical characters. So I'm not really sure, like, why Stephen King has, like, a history of doing that, but, mm-hmm. I mean, he obviously has at least three characters that are black, yeah. and
they all have are all magical. Magical, and then, like, die.
I can remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining. And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us. Just like you probably thought you was the only one. But there are other folks, though mostly they don't know it or don't believe it. How long have you been able to do it? Why don't you want to talk about it?
I'm not supposed to.
Who says you ain't supposed to?
Tony.
Who's Tony?
Tony is a little boy that loves my mom.
Is Tony the one that tells you things?
Yes.
How does he tell you things?
It's like I go to sleep and he shows me things. But when I wake up, I can't remember everything.
Does your mom and dad know about Tony?
Yes.
Do they know he tells you things?
No, Tony told me never to tell him.
Has Tony ever told you anything about this place? About the Overlook Hotel?
I don't know.
Now think real hard, Doc. Think.
Maybe he showed me something.
Try to think of what it was.
Darling, are you scared of this place?
No. Scared of nothing here. It's just that, you know, some places are like people. Some shine and some don't. I guess you could say the Overlook Hotel here has something about it that's like shining.
Is there something bad here?
Well, you know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast. Well, maybe things that happen leave other kind of traces behind. Not things that anyone can notice, but things that people who shine can see. Just like they can see things that haven't happened yet. Well, sometimes they can see things that happened a long time ago. I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
What about room 237?
Room 237?
You're scared of room 237, ain't you?
No, I ain't.
Mr. Allen, what is in room 237?
Nothing. There ain't nothing in room 237. But you ain't got no business going in there anyway. So stay out. You understand? Stay out.
I just really like the haunted house elements in the film. And I just like how the hotel just slowly reveals itself to each character. So we have Danny sort of getting, seeing visions of the blood coming out of the elevator, which was that made with a miniature?
I don't know. Like, I remember you shared something with me that was like, it was definitely a miniature, but I was like, that would make sense.
Yeah.
That it would, because how would you do that with like something so large?
So huge. It's such a great scene. So So Danny sees that vision, and is that like his psychic ability, or is it the hotel sort of like calling to him? Like that's it. That's, I don't know. That's what I like about this movie, is that the hotel is a character, and it seems to be like reaching out to this family.
That's such a good way of thinking of it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, Wendy, the hotel reveals itself to her as she is running around near the end. Like she sees the blood coming out of the elevator. She sees like the furry situation happening, and then like all the skeletons. Like she kind of like runs the gauntlet for that. And then yeah, obviously Jack is entangled with the hotel like right off the bat.
Yeah, something that I don't understand though is like that very end scene of him like in the picture. Do you know what that means?
I think maybe it's just like this sort of like toxic behavior will just like continue to repeat itself. Like history repeats itself.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I mean, that I always thought that it was like he was like a ghost the whole time or something, which I don't think that's what it was. But I'm like, why was he in the picture in the 40s? But it's probably just like, you know, like a self-centered, like abusive thing.
Or it's just the hotel like needing certain people.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a mystery. If you know, please let us know at bikinidriving@gmail.com.
But you know, the whole Shelley Duvall thing. I love her. I love her so much. I loved her in Three Women. I don't know if you've seen that video. I mean, I know you have. Hello, I'm Shelley Duvall. Yeah. The best. I don't even know what that's from,
I forget what it's called.
It's like Good Night with Shelley Duvall, or like Bedtime something.
It was like from a fairy tale show.
Yeah, it's very adorable. You should look it up on YouTube. It's cute. But sadly, our beloved Shelley was treated like total crap by Stanley Kubrick, and it took quite a toll on her mental and physical health. Mm-hmm. I got these facts from a video by a user who's like some TikToker named Kelita Rosita, along with some videos of Shelley Duvall actually talking about her experience, mm-hmm. and then some videos of Stanley Kubrick's daughter doing like some behind the scenes videos. But Shelley Duvall filmed The Shining for 13 months. While filming, she was completely isolated. She'd just gone through a breakup and was away from her family and was overseas. Mm-hmm. Stanley Kubrick just wanted to break her down. He ordered the cast and crew not to speak to her, not to compliment her, not to say anything positive to her, and just like to completely ignore her altogether.
Which is so vile. That's so awful. Yeah.
He would constantly berate her, tell her she was wasting everybody's time. And anytime she had like a suggestion, he would just shoot it down. He wanted her to feel bad basically all the time. So her emotions were like very genuine. And then Shelley became physically ill from this mistreatment, and she started losing her hair. And there's like a video of Stanley Kubrick saying like, don't sympathize with Shelley. Like it doesn't help her, which is like, what?
Yeah.
And then another thing Stanley Kubrick would do is just cut her lines without warning her. He would have Shelley go blindly into the scenes and just not tell the other person, or not tell her what the other person was going to say or do, because he just wanted her to act in like complete terror. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Stanley Kubrick, as much as I absolutely love this movie, mm-hmm. he was such a jerk, abusive, gaslighty person. I feel like I love this movie so much because I've like read the book and like I just love the story so much. Like obviously it's a beautiful film and like I watch it like every year because it's great, but can't ignore the fact that it was really bad for her. So
yeah, and like it is such a wonderful emotional performance, but like at what cost?
Yeah.
Right? And like she's acting like an abused woman because she was an abused woman. Yes. Like, and like, what do you, I don't know.
where's the line?
Where's the line? And also, like, what are you doing, like, treating, again, like, I'm not too sure, like, what it looks like behind the scenes, but again, like, late 1970s in film is, like, probably a lot of dudes behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And you're treating, like, the only woman in your movie, like, complete garbage, and meanwhile you're, like, buddy-buddy with Jack Nicholson, like,
oh yeah,
that go to hell.
Well, I'm like, I just kind of read, no, I read that, like, it took them 127 takes mm-hmm. to do the, like, baseball bat scene
yeah.
on the stairs, and, like, Shelley Duvall's hands were, like, bleeding, and yeah. I'm like, you know, you hear about that side of it, but it's like, so did Jack, like, he was just, like, fine with this? Like, yeah. what?
Yeah. It's just, it's yes, weird. It seemed like such a gross, toxic environment.
Yeah, I
agree. Ugh, this movie. Anyway, thanks for listening. you can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 4:30. And also on Spotify and iTunes. Usually it's loaded on Monday mornings. You can follow us on Facebook at Bikini Drive-In, on Twitter, Bikini Drive-In. I also have a Facebook viewing party coming up of Ginger Snaps with some pals from the Toxic Femme Films Facebook group. So, yeah, so that'll be next Friday, September 18th at 8:30 Eastern Time. And we're taking donations for Girls Rock Winnipeg. We're showing some short films by Stacey Ponder, Leslie Subnett, and Gwen Trutnow. So, yeah, so please tune in. That'll be really fun. And Talia, thank you so much for being on the show and for talking about this movie with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's as much as I talk about things I didn't like about it, it's one of my favorite movies. So
yeah,
I just love
yeah,
it.
I know. It is like it's such a wonderful film, but at the same time, like it's important to I don't know. We can still like something and then be critical of how it was made and how Shelley Duvall was treated.
Yeah,
justice exactly. for Shelley.
There's a little bit of fire on my neighbor's so say something, say something. You wanna set something with me? Well, take it up to Route 21. All the creatures gonna have their fun. An underworld danger, underworld scum. Take it up to Route 21 in a town hall where my vampire girls live. Say something, say something. Well, a underworld danger, underworld scum. Take it up to Route 21. Down the hole, my vampire girl too. Say something, say something. You wanna stop something with me here at Hotel? Hotel, Hotel, Hotel. Jump to me when it comes out of the goon. Hotel, Hotel, Hotel.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.